I had a conversation last week with somebody that's been in my life for a long time. We've probably known one another for about 15 years. And this is somebody who is who is undergoing tremendous suffering at this point in their life. There's emotional pain and physical pain and mental anguish and spiritual distress. And, oh, by the way, they're unemployed. And that's coming to a point where it's like, if I don't find something soon, I'm going to be living on the street. And it's a pretty big schmoz. There's just a lot of suffering in their life. And in this particular person's story, a lot of that distress is tangled up with their own religious experiences, and in particular with the ways in which one parent abandoned the family, the remaining one's religious beliefs had a shape that produced a unique sort of abuse. And so that's part of the story. And yet this is a person who can't, I mean, when I hear their story, I just think, and you still look toward God as good, and you still have this thing inside of you that says, I want to be intimate with the divine. Like, you know, it just won't go away. And it seems that almost no one and nothing could knock it out of them, you know? It's quite remarkable. But how complex is that? Like, how complicated is it when you can't let go of that longing, but you can't pursue it in the ways that were handed to you as a kid, right? That's complicated. And one of the things that I was reminded of in the course of that conversation is how much more complicated and difficult all of that can be when we either try to or are somehow compelled to journey alone. That's a bad idea as an idea. It's a difficult circumstance as a circumstance. It's a lie if we believe that we somehow must do it. There's just nothing good about that idea that we should go on alone. We need other people that are willing to walk with us, and we need people that'll walk with us without judging us, without feeling like they need to fix us. We need people that'll just walk with us, that'll sometimes trudge with us, that'll just sit with us when we're stuck, when we're not going anywhere. I had it in my notes on Tuesday that I'm glad for the ways I see that happening in this community, and I was fascinated to come this morning and hear us talk about it together. Right? It's just, this is not about compare and contrast, it's just about gratitude. It's just when it happens, it's good, good, good. And I'm so grateful. It's an interesting thing to try to share something from your own heart or your own life with a group of people, because you know going in that the place that you're coming from is personal, that it's your experience or perspective or journey, and you know that that's not going to be resonant with everybody. And in fact, you know that it's going to leave some people out. So when Jane talks about her childhood experience of growing up Catholic, That's not equally resonant for Ray and I, for instance. Ray's not here this morning, but, you know, for people who grew up Catholic, I mean, I grew up in some kind of a curious blender of Mennonite light and evangelicalism. The Catholics were people that needed to be evangelized, you know. Anyway, when Kathy talks about being a mom, you know, similarly, that's not going to be equally resonant for people for whom that experience of motherhood is either foreign or to whom those for whom it might be frightening or repugnant, as Kathy talked about it being in her own life before she had the experience, right? That transformational journey that you went on. Never mind what talking about motherhood or parenting is like in a culture where this whole binary family model is just evolving at light speed, right? Every time I think about the changing shape of family in our culture, I'm reminded that we could now have a virgin birth without divine intervention. That's not a little shift, right? It's not a little shift. Anything specific or focused by its very specificity creates a particular space in which not everything else feels equally at home. And so that's the challenge of being specific, and perhaps it has a unique shape in a community that would ideally, this community, ideally provide equal comfort and open-armed welcome for everyone and anyone. How do you be specific in a setting like that without doing damage? And the dilemma doesn't go away when we get specific about things that might be thought of as religious in nature. We've been exploring prayer over the past weeks. For lots of folks, prayer is a religious thing, right? It's a ritual, a habit, a custom, a thing you do if you are a religious person. After our gathering last week, Ray and I were chatting about this, and he reminded me that when Jesus talked about prayer, he suggested that it was something we should go into the closet to do, right? That there is, in the essence of prayer, there's something deeply hidden or secret or mysterious about it. That whatever else we think it is, at its heart, there's that. That said, Jesus is also portrayed as offering public prayers on a few occasions, so we're not looking at a new rule here. This is not a new law of a prayer. And in our own reflections over the past weeks, we've considered prayer from several points of view, including images like stepping into a current that's already moving or joining in this never-ending, generative, expanding love and creativity that is God. We've talked about prayer as being attentive. We've talked about prayer as a practice that can help us as humans to become participating points for the entry and expansion of grace in the world. We've talked about prayer as prefiguring the future. If those phrases sound unfamiliar to you, I'm failing as a communicator. They're all things we've talked about. Anyway, I want to pick up on the last one a little bit this morning, the idea that prayer can be an important way of bringing our imagination to bear on what the preferred future might look like, which is what I mean by the phrase prefiguring the future. And when I talk about what the preferred future would be like, I'm not talking about some other time and some other place. I'm talking about here and now. I'm not talking about some future after we die. When I talk about prayer as prefiguring the future, I'm talking about us humans, our lifetime. I remain of the conviction that spirituality that doesn't make us better humans is pretty much a waste of time. And also something that is, among other things, foreign to the teaching of Jesus. And I would say that that's pretty easily visible, primarily in the reaction of the early followers of the rabbi Jesus, who, having encountered this radical way that Jesus talked about and lived, of union with the divine present in the human experience, they couldn't seem to help but go to work on the problems that were all around them. It was like a knee-jerk reaction almost. And I'm not talking about the things we might typically think of as religious problems. I think Jesus, frankly, would be mortified at the religion we've made that has the name of Christ attached to it almost all the time. Jesus didn't come to start a religion. Like, it's just so not visible in the story. This is the thing we made because it's partly what we do. So I'm not saying it's wrong. I think it's just fundamentally human. I just don't think it was the mission Jesus was on at all. And when we start to treat our religion as though it's an extension of the mission of Jesus, we have to be a little bit careful about that. Having said that, when the people who encountered Jesus and the way of Jesus in the world started to go, now, what does it look like to live in that way? One of the things that they did was went to work on the common problems. So not on the religious problems. That came later after our religion got more formed. Right? Once we started to turn the way of Jesus into a religion, then we had religious problems. This should not have been a shock. It shouldn't be a shock now. But that wasn't the initial response. The initial response is, what's going on around us? What are the problems in the world around us, and how do we go to work on that? Because this is so obviously part of the way. And the problems then were remarkably similar to the problems now. They were things like people that were being marginalized or going hungry and thirsty, or the cost of unforgiveness, or religion that divides, or runaway greed or consumption, or the agony of feeling like you're alone in the universe. I mean, they were just, you know, all the stuff that we can see now. And when I think about prayer in this regard, it's kind of interesting, because when I think about the problems that are all around me, and I think about how I tend to pray about them, it occurs to me that it's one thing to pray about those kind of problems as though we had nothing to do with them, and as though prayer was a way of getting them off our plate and onto God's agenda. It is another matter entirely to pray about those kind of things as though God's agenda was to keep them on our plate. Totally different. Just totally changes the way you pray. And this is a topic for another day, but let me just duck into a side path for a moment to say that whenever I talk about God keeping things on our plate, my working assumption is that we are never without God. That's the baseline for me. And I would say that the New Testament story from Jesus onward is full of this evolving understanding that the new temple, the new home of the divine, is us. We were kind of joking about this in another conversation here this morning during setup, talking about the ridiculousness of the idea that God would fit into a particular room in a particular building. And yet there's this density of symbols in the Old Testament that has sort of those sorts of shapes. Well, it's easy to kind of look at that and go, that's ridiculous. Not just inside a building, but inside a particular room in a building, right? And then we're kind of talking about this whole symbol of the curtain tearing and so on and so forth, the way the story evolves and the way the story unfolds. In the end, what the biblical record says more than anything else, especially Paul, who isn't an easy writer to understand, but if you start to read Paul, and instead of reading, if depending where you grew up theologically, instead of reading the teachings of Paul as though they're primarily about grace, not a bad idea, just try reading them as though they were primarily about the idea that the new temple of the divine is us, and you will find it just everywhere, that his perspective is so powerfully that the new home of God on earth and the evolving understanding launched by the Hebrew story and moving forward is that humanity is the home of the divine. So we're never without God. That's the working understanding. And if you think about that Old Testament story that lays out in all these details, there's buildings and rules and sacrifices, there's a tribe of priests. Increasingly, when I read that story, what I feel like I'm reading is a record of ways of trying to imagine where the mystery that we call God might reside. How do we picture this? How do we interact with this? Right? Well, how do we interact with it materially? How do we interact with it architecturally? How do we interact with it ideologically? How do we interact with it religiously? How do we interact with it ritually? How do we interact with it culturally? How do we interact with it as a nation, nationally? Right? It's just this gigantic experiment in that story. And then when Jesus comes along, if I was going to try to sum up that transition, I would say that Jesus essentially says, God and I are one, and God and you are as well. So since that's settled, could we get on with working at the hunger and thirst that's everywhere that we look? Like, could we get at it? Because cosmically, we got this. Right, so now what? And so it's in that spirit that I want us to do something a little bit different this morning. I'm going to give us an opportunity to reimagine, or to use the language I've been using, to prefigure what it means to build a wall. And yes, that's deliberate. You know, like the one that keeps cropping up in the news but never on the border, like that one. I want us to try to take that image back. Because that's become a really super sticky image, right? In this season in our culture. Given, this is an opinion, so this is purely editorial, given that it's highly unlikely that a physical wall will come to be, I think the probability of this becoming a metaphor for a bunch of things in our culture is actually very high. And so that's a good opportunity in terms of cultural movement to kind of get into the conversation. At this point, that image, for many of us, I'm fine with speaking for myself directly as well, is so negative and divisive and hateful, and so not consistent with the bridge-building perspective that characterized Jesus' insistence that the love of God couldn't fit inside cultural or religious borders. It just feels like it's time to not just let that be. It's time to actually take a moment and think differently about that. Reimagine that. Reconsider what it might mean as humans to be wall builders. We're going to engage in this exercise with the help of a poet and of some Old Testament texts about mercy and justice. The poetry part is important because, whether you like poetry or not, when it comes to talking about the springs and rhythms of life, about the impenetrable mysteries that reside at this intersection of suffering and action, probably only poets and mystics should try to put words around this stuff. And in this particular case, the poem that we're going to use in this exercise has the added credibility of being written by someone that lived inside the suffering and the challenge that they write about. So this is not a privileged person speculating on suffering, this particular poet. The poem is called The Wall. It was written in 1959 by Nicolas Joelen. I know I'm killing that. It's a Cuban name. By the time he wrote this, which was in 1959, he was born in the early 1900s. By the time he wrote this, he had become essentially Cuba's national poet. But he didn't start there. Joelen's story started out as an Afro-Cuban child. And so because of his African heritage, but living in a Cuban culture, he was subject to a lot of bullying and a lot of abuse, a lot of racial abuse. And as the story unfolded historically, that didn't break his spirit. He went on to have a long and productive career as a writer and a social activist on many different justice issues, and he eventually became, and history would now regard him as really one of the representative writers of Cuban culture. So became a fairly towering figure as regards justice questions in that culture as a writer. We're going to be working with the English translation, of course, because I'm not a Spanish speaker, and even if I was, I think that doesn't represent the majority of us. But if you want to hear the poem, and this is well worth doing, if you want to hear the poem in its original language and read by the author, the Google Verse can deliver that for you. It's a 1950s recording. It has all the sonic characteristics of that. It's gorgeous in Spanish. And to my ears, surprisingly gentle, which might make more sense once we encounter the poem. I've had some time to sit with it, so I have an advantage, I know. But I expected more militancy. Anyway, in terms of translation, it's worth noting before we actually look at the poem together that the particular word for wall that is used in the poem in the original Spanish is a bit unique to the Spanish language, which has more than one word for wall. It's a Spanish word that is mostly related to things like forts, castles, any wall that is erected with defensive purposes. To an English equivalent word might be something more like rampart, right? Which is a fairly forceful word for wall. It's not like garden fence, right? This is a robust, muscular sort of image. And in this case, in the case of the poem, it has a weight to it that's beyond simply describing the heft or material of something, like what it's made of or its visible sort of presence. And it's more about an image that has to do with defense in times of violence and danger. And as a result, in the poem, the wall kind of morphs. It kind of doesn't stay defensive. It actually becomes an image for unity and strength as well, which is quite interesting and pretty important in the context of what we're going to do. So what we're going to do is we're going to read the poem out loud together, but we're not just going to read through it, right? The poem is structured such that it has a narrator, and it has a couple of groups, and it has an opportunity for the groups to come together. So I was going to put it on the screen, but I don't like the way that makes us look physically. I don't mean it makes us appear. I mean where we look, all right? When I was making copies for this, I thought, oh, this is a good exercise. How many copies should I make? It's the long weekend. Yes, it's raining. No, we don't usually gather on the May long weekend. Right? Historically, this has been when we've changed to Wednesday nights. And so that's, we haven't usually gathered on this date. So I guessed. And I made enough. All right, so we're going to divide the room down the middle, just because that kind of makes sense. Give it one more here, so you guys, you got enough? And the group on, can everybody see a copy? We're easy with that. So the group to my right, sort of from the sound console this way, is group one. everybody from the console that way is, no, I'm going to change that. Everybody from the console that way is group one. Everybody from the console this way is group two. That's just for my benefit, so I keep it straight. Okay, so what's going to happen is that I'm going to be the narrator, group one, group two, and that's all sort of laid out. So the middle stanza of the poem reads like what in our English parlance we would call a knock-knock joke, right? This knock-knock, who's there, is actually the structure of the poem, but it's not a joke. It's actually about the wall that the poem talks about making and whether the wall should be closed or opened to something. The wall, of course, is actually a unification of people. It's actually a coming together of people. And this group of people in the poem has to decide what they will open themselves to or what they will gather together to defend one another from. So that's the image, all right? So it's not just about a rampart that says nobody gets in here. There's a door, but we make it together. And there's a closing that can happen, but we make that together as well. To make this wall, bring me all of the hands. The blacks, their black hands. The whites, their hands of white. Ah, a wall that runs from the beach up to the hills, from the hills down to the beach. Yes, over along the horizon. For the heart of a friend, open up the wall. For poison and daggers, close up the wall. For myrtle and mint, open up the wall. For the fangs of a serpent, close up the wall. For the hummingbird on a flower, open up the wall. Together, let us raise up a wall by joining all the hands. The blacks, their black hands. The whites, their hands of white. A wall that runs from the beach up to the hills, from the hills down to the beach, yes, over along the horizon. A wall that leaves out no one is what that little bit of geographic description is about. A wall that welcomes all the nations in this culture, that joins them together. The blacks, their black hands, the whites, their hands of white, join together to make this rampart that can either open to what is good and lovely, and I so enjoy the poet's choice of images because they're both human and environmental. They're both about structure and about relationship. That closes and protects the people who've joined together from the things that are destructive and the things that are evil. That's a different kind of wall, right? I don't know how this works for you, but excuse me. Having spent some time with the poem, I find now that I have a little filter that's about walls and about conversations about walls in my culture. When people start talking about the wall, I have a different figure that comes to mind. I have a different way of imagining what it means to be a human that's a wall builder. Let's talk about building walls, shall we? Let's not talk about it. But let's understand that there is more than one way for this image to work in the world. There is more than one way for this to be symbolic. There is more than one way to imagine the future using the metaphor of a wall. So in the end, you know, and the mystics have said this over and over again, in the end, it's not the desires that are the problem. It's not the images that are the problem. It's what we make of them. It really is. So we can talk about making a wall. We don't have to become binary about conversations about walls. We have to become imaginative about them. And so when we pray about the wall that has time and space and our headlines and our culture, we can prefigure something different. We can imagine something different. We can then, and this is the way, this is the mystic part of this, it's very hard to know and impossible to demonstrate how the prayer and the prayer are formed by praying, but we are. What we imagine, science is increasingly dabbling in this, and they're finding themselves having to use theological language to describe it. It's quite fascinating. How the universe comes to know itself is the language that science uses, believe it or not, about these kinds of things. How is the future formed? That's pretty mysterious stuff. And I'm going to contend that one of the ways that the future is formed is by what we pray. Not because we ask God to come and alter what's happening in time and space, but because we are prefiguring it. We don't get to prefigure the future in a determinist way. This is too mysterious for that. It's not like pray it, believe it, and it happens. This is not that theology in disguise. If you didn't guess that by now. This is something way more mysterious and way less within our direct control than that. And yet, in which we are actors, not victims, in which we are participants, not passengers. We've talked about prayer in a whole bunch of different ways. I want to give us some time to pray in a way that is about listening and not telling the divine what to do. And with this metaphor in mind, what I want to do is just take a few minutes. I'm going to read a few of the key Old Testament justice texts to us. You won't have them in front of you. I'll just read them for you. So I'll read them one at a time, and I'll give us a few moments. And what I would invite you to do, and of course this is always a choice, right? This is not magic. This is not a new lever to get God to behave a certain way. But it's an opportunity to pay attention. What I would invite you to do is, with this question of, personally, does the image in this text about justice call out to me to open to something or to help people defend themselves, to help me defend myself, perhaps, from something? Is it an opening or a closing sort of picture that comes to mind from this text for you? All right? That's sort of the whole exercise. I can give you references later, but I'm just going to actually read the content of the text for us this morning. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Correct oppression. Bring justice to the fatherless. Plead the widow's cause. Thus says the Lord of hosts, render true judgments, show kindness and mercy to one another, do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the journeyer, or the poor. And let none of you devise evil against another in your heart. Open your mouth for the mute. For the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Thus says the Lord, do justice and righteousness, and deliver from the hand of the oppressor the one who has been robbed. And do no wrong or violence to the resident alien, the displaced, the fatherless, and the widow, nor shed innocent blood in this place. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. And in a text from the New Testament, the only one of the batch this morning, that must surely have been in Abraham Lincoln's imagination when someone asked him, why are you against slavery? And he said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not enslave. So, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. In other words, when we imagine our good life, when we prefigure what we think a good future looks like, we can just turn this around and it works just fine. Whatever you would wish, whatever you would prefigure as your good future, find a way also to offer this as possible for others. Not in specificity, we already talked about the problem of that, but in its principle. My picture of a good life isn't everyone's picture of a good life. But when we prefigure what is good, one of the things that the law and the prophets and the story of Jesus just keep saying over and over again is this is not just for you. This is not just for you. If it's just for me, it's actually not good. I heard an artist say this week in an irreligious context, the cure for greed is giving. The cure for consumption is to give. That's what they were on about, was the runaway consumption of our culture. I thought, wow, how about that? Wisdom translates. It translates quite beautifully if we just take the time to think about it and to try to imagine it in the world. That's prayer, people. Trying to imagine that future and then asking, what do I need to open my life to or help close out that is evil? And help others to open life to or help defend from because it's not good. That's the way we move toward that prefigured good future. That's how it works. And because we are never without God, and as the New Testament Jesus story would have it, because we are Christ, not bearers of Christ, but we're Christ. Like this is one of the most This is one of the most under-understood truths of Christian belief. We don't actually carry Christ into the world. That's not a bad idea. We don't actually imitate Christ. Also not a bad idea. We actually are. That's that idea. So there's that. All right? All right. Enough talking.